Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Get expert advice from your friendly healthcare team at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Good morning, you're very welcome to the show. So, the front pages today, the government formation talks don't really make the front pages, but it does sound like they're heating up, like the fella in the Hemingway novel, How Did You Go Broke? Gradually and then suddenly. So we're into a suddenly phase now. But you feel it could get, the government formation could get gradually again, but definitely it's all happening today and this weekend, it seems, so we keep an eye on that. But the front pages, such as they are, kind of a miscellany of things. The Irish Times is leading with AI body warns of facial recognition creep. Government plans for the use of facial recognition technology risk gradual mission creep towards a mass surveillance society, the state's expert group on artificial intelligence has warned. And of course, look, they'll argue that, like in the, say, in the case of the Dublin riots, the authorities will argue that, like, you know, Gardaí needing to pour over thousands and thousands of hours of cameras all over the city and stuff like that is not an ideal situation. But also, on the other hand, I think if we're learning anything in the last few years, is that, like, the things you think will never happen vis-a-vis technology and stuff, they kind of do happen. So you proceed with caution as well. The Daily Mail is leading with record rise in small businesses going bust. So the number of small businesses on the brink has hit an 8-year high, 875 insolvencies in 2024, with the restaurant sector among the worst affected. But they do mention there that the kind of deadline ran out on debt warehousing that companies had done during the pandemic. And I think a lot of companies went out of business rather than face paying back the money they owed, the revenue that they had warehoused. The Examiner is leading with judge wants peace deal verified. A district court judge has sought independent verification of a peace deal between feuding traveller families in Cork City after a number of men were charged with violent disorder. And in that this court report here, it says that Detective Garda Aidan Forrest gave evidence of a violent incident on January 6th at Hollyhill Shopping Centre in Cork, where 15 people were allegedly involved. The Star has flock and thaw, and this is the moment sheep were pulled from beneath 15 feet of snow after 5 days. You might have seen that footage. So I was kind of wondering, were the sheep not, like, why weren't they just buried, surrounded by snow and dead? But they went into a hollow and then snow kind of blew over them. So they were in a little cocoon down there, and that's why they survived. The Irish Independent is leading with majority of GPs are not taking new patients on. So this is a survey that they did themselves. So look, not exhaustive. It's a snap survey of 130 registered GPs nationwide, but 6 in 10 of them are not taking any new patients. And then the Mirror is leading with the LA fires. I've lost everything. Irishman tells how house burned down in LA wildfires. And this is Andrew Duggan from Cork. And I think he and his partner had a studio as well. They were running a business from their home, and there's a picture of it there. And like so many other people's houses, gone. And look, I know we say that, you know, there were, this same thing happened. I think Valparaiso and Chile, same thing happened in Hawaii. And did we pay enough attention then and everything? But I suppose, A, from the fact, as we can see with Andrew Duggan there, that there are so many of our own who have made kind of extraordinary lives for themselves out in LA. And also, it is a place, isn't it, that lives in our imaginations, and we know all those addresses, we know all those roads. A lot of people know it all from movies. I think for a lot of us who grew up reading about music and stuff in LA, it feels like we know all those places and we know that scene. So it does feel, I think, a little bit closer to home for us. But anyway, we'll come back to that over the weekend. Róisín and Anne Ingle, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Brendan.
And welcome back. And Róisín, you are an Irish Times journalist, of course, and co-presenter of the Women's Podcast. And Anne, you're a writer too. But I always feel your main job is mother to Róisín. writing is a job, but your vocation is mother to Róisín. And look, it's been a while. It was actually, I was looking back, it's October 2023 when you were both last in with us as our kind of mother and daughter agony aunt slash inspo life coaches. but it's been some year and a half or year and a bit since then. So Róisín, I think it was just after that last visit here.
Yeah.
As happens in life.
Absolutely.
Everything changed for you. So why did you decide you might need to go for a checkup?
Right. Well, I was lying in bed one night and this maybe I was when I say this, it sounds weird. I was idly just touching my breasts. And it wasn't
as one
anything.
Does.
Yeah, as one does. As one should, actually. And I found a bit of rough skin under my left nipple. And it wasn't a lump, which I think is important to say. So because often we're told, like, look for lumps and things like that in our breasts. It was just the skin felt different to what I would have expected. And then I went over on my right side and that rough skin wasn't there. So that sort of made me think, what's that all about? I better go and get that checked out. But I wasn't really that worried. I just thought I'll do the right thing. So the very next morning, I actually cancelled two podcasts for the women's podcast and I went to the clinic and I got myself checked out. And indeed, the person there thought there was it warranted getting further looked at. And 2 weeks later, I had an appointment in the breast check clinic in Eccles Street in the Matter. And I'd never had a mammogram before. I had several mammograms there. Then they took me upstairs to get an ultrasound. And while the woman was doing the ultrasound, I presume she must have seen something because then she said she was going to do a biopsy. So it all happened quite quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I was lying there kind of going, okay, this is now feeling a bit serious. And they took a biopsy, which is people will know is a little bit painful, but that was grand. And then I was brought into a room with a consultant and that morning they said they had found several tumours in my left breast and that they had to go and get the biopsy, actually, you know, the lab results and everything like that. But as far as they could see, that I had breast cancer and that, was quite shocking at the time.
Yeah. So within a few hours.
Which I would have thought, you know, you'd be waiting for a call from them or something. But no, they must have seen it all there on the ultrasound and it was very clear to them.
But I think in one way then, you know, a lot of us would spiral or go into why me or anything, but you kind of regained equanimity reasonably quickly, did you? And thought, well, why not me?
Like a little bit. Like I went round to mother's straight away because, as you said, that's my main safe place.
Yeah.
And I remember we drove round to Phibsborough and I told my mum what had happened. And yeah, we quickly did get into that place. The consultant said, you'll have a rough year. It will be hard, you know, possibly mastectomy, definitely chemotherapy and all the things that was going to have to happen. But I have lots of friends, Brendan, who have been through breast cancer and who are really thriving and surviving and they're wonderful people. And I had that role models. Like, I feel like that helped me. I thought to myself, it's my turn. It happens to a lot of women. And I believed in that I would have this rough year and then I would be okay. But obviously it was shocking. I'm not going to say I didn't expect that. I thought I was just doing the right thing and they would say, oh no, you're grand, you know. So it was shocking, but I did quickly regain a bit of equanimity. You're right.
Yeah. So you went back in on December 8th then?
Yeah, so they sent me for some more.
Kind of changed again.
Yeah, which was a bit more of much deeper shock. They sent me for tests. They do that with some people. I didn't know how often, but they sent me for bone scans and CT scans and all this kind of thing. And again, I kind of thought this was routine and this was just going to end up with me still having this one rough year and having breast cancer. But when I went back in on December 8th, they told me that it had spread to my bones and in my lymph nodes and that we were now in a different place. That before, I was still kind of clinging on to what they'd said before. I said, no, but you said I'd have a rough year. And she was like, no, it's different now because this is not something that we can, you know, necessarily cure, but that we can manage. And she said we can manage it for long years is what she said at the time. And it was very shocking. She put some tissues on the desk because, you know, obviously people cry, but I didn't cry. I felt like, I just felt very nauseous. I was worried I'd have to use the tissues to wipe up my sick off her desk because that's what the shock did to me. Shock affects people, I suppose, in different ways. And Johnny, my partner, was sitting there as well and we were both completely shocked. And we left there and again drove around to Phibsborough to my mum. And that was a very different kind of experience then.
I presume you're not even taking it in.
Not really.
The gravity of it.
Well, yeah. I mean, in a way you are. It's totally gravity because it's like, I don't know if you would feel like that, but if somebody tells you it's spread to your bones and they mention, you know, a different stage of cancer and they talk about it not being something you can deal with, like in a way that you can deal with breast cancer when it's only a breast cancer diagnosis, that you can remove the breast, have chemotherapy and you can carry on your life. You know, it's a different thing. I was going to be moving to the oncology department rather than the breast clinic. And so, yeah, I was spiraling, I suppose. Like, and I think I went back and I told you, Mum, and you, it was a very, I would say, a dark day. I would call it a dark day.
Yeah, I bet. And a dark day for you, Anne, as well.
Yeah, I was absolutely devastated. It was the worst day of my life so far, I think, really. I tried to hold it together while Roisin was there with Johnny. But when she was gone, I just collapsed into tears and I was really, really sad. And I said to my youngest daughter, Katie, I don't want Roisin to die. That's all I could think about. And it was really bad. I mean, that wasn't what I should have been doing, but that's the way it hit me. I was really, really down at the bottom. And I went to bed that night and I didn't sleep and I cried lots more. And took me, I don't know, we were on this journey. Well, Roisin hates the word journey, yeah, but we are together in our way of thinking. So whilst, like Roisin, I did not go to the Google. I didn't want to know exactly what was going on. She had the professionals looking after her, and that was good enough for me, so that was out. But anything relating to ancillary matters, I would look up, you know, if something happened. And you find when something like that comes to your life, you know, it's like when you're pregnant, you see millions of pregnant women. It was like this, you know, when Roisin had this terrible news, lots of other things came into the mind. Like there was a Guardian article, I think, the next day saying what not to say to people who've got cancer, you know. So I immediately circulated that to all the family so they'd be aware whether or not to say.
And what are the things not to say? Because actually,
you'd
I think a lot of people...
You'd be surprised at the silly things people say. Like, how did you get it? I mean, people actually say that. What caused it? Ridiculous. Or my aunt has got that. I mean, who cares? I mean, really, it's my daughter. I don't care whether your aunt has got it or not. Mm-mm. You know, that kind of thing. So I did that. There was something useful I was doing immediately, right? Still with this low feeling in me. But then it was all down to Roisin after that, I think, and the way she behaved. Well, yeah. I don't know.
And how did you behave?
Well, I was in shock, and I don't think there's anything you can do about the shock, because it's a physical, mental, emotional thing. And when you get news like that, you kind of go into some kind of place, and it's only time that gets you out of that. So I couldn't do anything about the shock. But I went to, I remember going home. I had a very... we had told the girls I had breast cancer, but we were wondering whether to tell them about this. And then we did do a little bit of Googling because we decided we would tell them this extra bit of news, because we found a lot of teenagers on the internet saying, you think you're helping us by not telling us the whole story, but actually you're making it worse, because then we can't trust you. We don't know what's real and what's not real. So we decided we would tell them, but we had a little bit. I think we did an hour before the girls came home from school to kind of get ourselves ready to tell this latest bit. And I remember opening the fridge. This is a big moment of it. And seeing this bottle of wine there, a very nice bottle of wine. And I had this real big sensation that if I could just neck that bottle of wine and then go to bed, that it would all kind of disappear. And I was really visceral. Like, it's very, I can feel myself now, even back there at the fridge door. But then almost at the exactly same time, I had this other amazing, and I don't know where it came from. I'm not going to get all woo woo, but it was like a voice, or it was like a sensation that actually that would be the worst thing that I could do. And that not only would it be worse, it would make everything worse. And that the really important thing I needed to do from now on was that I had to feel everything. Even though there was going to be really hard feelings,
okay,
I had to feel them in order to be able to deal with what I was going to have to deal with. And that all came very quickly in that moment. And actually at that moment, I realised that I was never going to drink alcohol again, because I know that I used alcohol in the past for a long, long time to numb myself from a lot of things and also to celebrate happy things. But a lot of the time, if things were hard, that the wine would help with that. You know, the wine will take the edge off that, will make it better. And it was a massive, I think it was the shock really just shocked me into the realisation that that was absolutely not the right way to go. And numbing it was not the way to go. I had to feel everything. I think that was the beginning of me realising that's how I was going to deal with it. So it meant that I did lie in bed crying. I did cry. I had a couple of sleepless nights, but not many, because I did this thing where my brain started to spiral when it started to tell me I was going to die, say, or, you know, I would actually talk to myself and I'd be like, OK, I can see why you're saying that. And that's natural that you'd be afraid. But I'm listening to Dr. Emily Harold, who's my incredible consultant in the matter public. And she says you can have long years. She says you can manage this. She says there's X, Y and Z treatments. So that's what I'm listening to. And obviously we're a bit scared as well, but let's not go there. So it was about kind of framing it in a certain way that would allow me to get up every morning with a smile on my face and not just feel like everything was terrible. And gradually,
is that putting a brave face on it, Roisin, or is that a real smile you're able to?
No, it's not putting a brave face on it. But I understand why you're asking that. But for me, it wasn't. It was a case of basically framing it in that way and then living that, and that allowed that to happen. And I was then, very quickly, I was sleeping really well and I was getting up every morning and not consumed with dread. When the shock subsided, because you can't do anything about the shock, when the shock went, I found myself in a very solid, safe place of listening to the experts, knowing that things that were good were still going to be happening, and trying to get my children and my partner into that place as well so that we could all enjoy our Christmas, really.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, 10 days after I got that news, I fell and broke my ankle.
And before we get to that,
yeah.
So I won't pry into the conversation with the girls and all that kind of thing, but just in general, people will be wondering.
It must be devastating
for the family, and how you managed that with them.
It was really hard. They were really angry, actually, which I understand. They were pissed off, you know. It is Christmas time. We're talking about presents and having fun. And they're, you know, they're two lovely teenagers, very emotionally intelligent. They felt it wasn't fair, that it was really unfair. And I was trying to say to them, it's not about fairness. Like, these kind of things happen to lots and lots of people. They've happened and they will happen. And we can't think like that, because we're still going to have a lovely Christmas and it's still going to be OK. I just told them that it was more serious now. It was something like, one of my daughters said, well, I can't wait till you're able to ring that cancer bell that says you haven't got it anymore. And I just had to explain to them that actually that maybe isn't what my experience is going to be, because this is about managing it, not completely getting rid of it, you know. So that was hard, because they found that hard to understand. But they were very good. And even though one of my children did say, this, what's the point of Christmas now? This is the worst, whatever. We ended up having a lovely Christmas. So it was great for them to be able to see that even with this really dark stuff, you can still have joy, you can still have fun, and things still can carry on if you choose to let it, you know.
Okay. Until you had your accident.
I was going to. Okay, because bad enough, all of that. And then I was going to a lovely carol service in St. Patrick's Cathedral, which is one of the things we love to do as a family. The girls used to go to the choir school there, so we have an affinity, and they'd invited us. So on the way, there was a slippery path. I slipped and I broke my ankle. That was on the 18th of December. So then I had to get an ambulance to the matter, and I'm trying to tell them, yeah, I've got this broken ankle, but meanwhile, also look at my file. There's all this other stuff as well. And then I had to get an operation to get a titanium plates in my ankle, because it was quite a bad break. So I was in hospital for 5 days, but I came out on the 23rd of December and had a lovely, we do a cousin's Christkindle, all of mother's grandchildren get together and they do a Christkindle. I went to that, and that really for me was a signal. We had a lovely time. It was beautiful, even though I was sitting there in my boot and my crutches and everything. It was great. And I saw then, no, life is still okay. I can manage this. It'll be all right, you know. And that was the beginning of it, I think.
Wow. I'm in awe of that, I have to say, because whatever about everything else, then the ankle happening as well. Like, I'm with your girls, the unfairness of it all. Mm. And so did you start chemo after
so
Christmas
we had to
then?
So the ankle delayed it, because you can't get chemotherapy when you've had another injury that you're healing from. So I started on the immune targeted therapy, which is something I'm still on, and which something I'll always be on. That started, that's an injection in your thigh every 3 weeks. So I started on that, and then when the ankle had healed enough, I started on the chemotherapy. And that was that was very daunting, because
it can be very, very rough.
Yeah, and the idea of it, and we see things in the movies, and it's, you know, but I have to say, I went into the Mater Public Cancer Day ward. People in there are just incredible. I mean, I would just like to mention a couple of their names, Albert and Camille and Noel. Brilliant, brilliant people who made it, if you can. I mean, I remember texting a friend after that first day, that first chemotherapy infusion, to say, if it's possible to have a nice day in a cancer day ward, I just had one. You know, that's how amazing they made me feel, how safe they made me feel. It's just this care that comes over you. And it's not easy, chemotherapy, as anyone listening who has had it knows. It's very hard. It takes a lot out of you, and it takes a lot out of people in different ways. And there's lots of things that can happen to you because your immune system is so kind of debilitated. But yeah, they were incredible in that place, and I'm so grateful to them. And I continue to go in there every 3 weeks for my immune therapy, and I don't mind going in. I love seeing them. I feel very cared for, you know. So that was hard. And then, of course, I fell down the stairs and did my other leg.
Oh, man. Oh, you should have seen that. It was
terrible. Couldn't tell Mother that for a few days because how can I say I've also done this? Do you remember, Mum?
I do remember very well. But the thing was about going, Jess, back a little bit, Brendan.
Yeah.
I am... When after the initial thing was happening, and I just wanted to be with her all the time. I wanted to cuddle her and you know, share our thing. And I realized from previous experience in my life that this was going to become a codependency thing, which is not good for her or me. So I was always there for her. Roisin knows that all the time. But there was many days that I wanted to ring her. I wanted to ring her 10 times a day to say what? How are you feeling? What does that mean? So I refrained from doing that. And I waited for her to ring me. And then when she did, I was so happy. And the way that she has been describing her attitude to the people in the hospital and the way she behaved, it is infectious for me. The two of us were as one then with our attitude to what was going on with her, even despite the bloody big boot on her leg. And the you should have seen the thing on the front of the leg.
And the other leg.
Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah, that was bad.
It was horrific.
So Roisin held it together for everybody in a way, did she? Once she managed to do that, you got on board. Does that work for Johnny and the girls as well?
Yes, exactly. That's the thing. And like going back to your brave face, it's not that. I genuinely was feeling that. I believed what Emily Harold was saying. I believed I would manage this for long years. So then why was I going to get all into a dark place all the time? That wasn't where I was at. So then I kept talking about that to the girls and to Johnny and to my mum. And then we would ring each other up. And there was a bit of positive brainwashing probably. Like I'd often ring my mum and we'd probably have the same conversation 100 times, which is like, oh, do you remember when Emily Harold said that everything was going to be okay and I can manage it for long years? And my mum would go, that she said that. I was like, it sounds really weird, but it was kind of like reinforcing the bits that made sense and that we were able to deal with. And it was, and then we got on the same page very quickly.
And the other thing I did,
and then you weren't worried, you weren't sleeping badly, and you weren't
but the other positive thing I did was I started a daily diary from December the 8th, well, before December the 8th, actually, from the very first beginning. And every day I wrote about what was happening, what was happening to me mentally and what was happening to her, so that I have this chronicle. And I even put in photographs. I have photographs on the Microsoft Word of her with her boot and her with a bad bump on her leg. I have it all there. It's all documented from right that way, from October right the way through. So that was something I did. Something I did every day. It gave me something
purpose
to do, even if it was just, you know.
Yeah.
I found it.
And get it out, puke it onto a page.
And now Roisin is delighted to, sometimes she rings and says, what happened on that day? I have it all documented there.
So you're the Boswell of this journey. And you got married as well.
Yeah, so when I was in with my other leg, so I ended up doing in my right leg. So my left leg and right leg were now banjaxed, and I had to get another operation, which was draining some liquid out of my leg and a skin graft. And when I was in hospital, I don't know what drugs they gave me for that operation, but I was very high out of my head on that. I was some
quite
good stuff, whatever it was. And while I was in that haze, my sisters came in to see me in the matter, and I was saying, oh, Johnny has been so amazing. How am I ever going to thank him? And my sister Katie said, well, you know, February 29th is coming up. Why don't you ask him to marry you? Because we've been together for 24 years. And my sister Katie had actually done that with her husband.
Yeah.
So I said, oh my God, Katie, that's amazing. I was off my head now. But then when I calmed down, I still thought it was a good idea. And then on the 29th of February, in a lovely dinner in the Marion garden room, I got down on one knee totally. He was like, don't go down on your knee.
Yeah.
I asked him, and it was very funny because Johnny had no clue about this tradition where the woman can ask the man on the 29th. So he was just completely confused. But I brought brought a lovely tie that I bought, a silk tie, and I said, will you tie the knot with me? And that was lovely. He said yes. My daughters were a bit worried that he wouldn't say yes. That was funny. And then I spent the rest of my chemotherapy time kind of planning a wedding, and we got married in July, and that was just the most incredible day, wasn't it, Mum?
Oh my God, yes.
I mean, I know everyone loves their wedding, but this, I didn't expect to like my wedding as much as I did, because, you know, when you're together 24 years and your children are 15, you know, it's like, is it going to be the same? Even the celebrant was like, well, it's like Johnny and Roisin have been together for a while, and your vows are all like, I know I'm really annoying, but still, thanks for staying with me all this time. And, you know, it's much more real in a way. It's not got all that kind of lovely romantic hope. It's a different kind of romance.
Yeah, yeah, it's a realistic
wedding. And I had this beautiful dress made by Anne O'Mahony, which was just this riot of pink tulle. I mean, it was incredible. And we danced down the aisle, you and I, didn't we? To Matrimony by Gilbert O'Sullivan, which was, we love Gilbert O'Sullivan since I was
very young. But he sent you a text yesterday.
And then he sent me an email during the week, actually, because I wrote a column in the Irish Times, and he sent me an email to say how proud he was that we did that, which was just amazing.
No, that was not nice of him. Yeah.
Raymond is a lovely man. Yeah, he's great.
But the wedding was great because there was singing and the girls sang, and then Patsy McGarry of the Irish Times gave an account of how they met.
Yeah, because Johnny and I met in a riot, and Patsy was being very protective of me at the time up in the north in Portadown, and he was trying to keep me and Johnny apart because he didn't think this was a good idea, him being from the other side of the Drumcree Hill, being a Protestant. And so Patsy got up and made this amazing speech about how he nearly prevented this whole thing happening. So there was a lot of fun and joy.
There were all the northern
Protestants, over there, and we had the blackbird.
You can say it, Protestants.
She was
reluctant to utter the word.
She used to be on
the airwaves.
We had the blackboard from Dairy Girls at the wedding. You know, with all the differences between Protestants and Catholics. Yeah. We had so many funny things like that. It was hilarious. And Queenie, my husband's mother, was just in her element, and it was just the best day
and the
ever.
The singing was amazing, and the dancing. It just went on for all hours. I had to leave.
It didn't really go on for all hours. It was a reasonable ending wedding.
Well, I was gone before it ended.
Yeah, you were long gone.
And it must have been emotional too.
Oh, yes, it was very emotional. But I was just so happy for her and for him, because he's such a lovely fella, you know, and he puts up with a lot, you know. She's not an easy woman to live with, as you can imagine.
Thanks a lot.
But
I just have to say as well, like, the whole thing, my brother-in-law Killian came into the hospital when I did my other leg in, and I got C. diff and I got E. coli, and he shaved all my hair off because it started to come out. And I had this beautiful woman called Stephanie from Calla Crowns. I have to tell anyone, if anybody has any wig issues, Stephanie from Calla Crowns, she came on the day of the wedding and styled my wig. And so I had this beautiful wig that was kind of like my old hair, because I was bald at this point.
Your new hair is quite cool.
I'm liking my new hair. You know, my children say I'm rocking it, so I'm slaying it. I think slay is the word.
Slay is the word.
Yeah, I've got short. I used to have very long hair and very thick, and I loved my hair, as some people would say it was part of my personality, you know. But now I have the short, thick grey hair, and it's fine. You know, I'm happy with that. I would like to say something about the chemotherapy. Just because I got this cold therapy gloves and things for my feet, which can help with the neuropathy symptoms that you can get from chemotherapy, and just that not many people know about it. And I'd just like to say to people, if anyone's going through it, that they helped me and I didn't get those symptoms, so it might be something that people might be interested in.
Okay, and they'd be able to find them online?
Yeah, on Amazon, anywhere online they can find them, yeah.
Okay. Listen, you talked about giving up drinking. You also gave up social media this year.
I know, on the same day, actually.
Yeah.
I realised that moment. And I had like quite a few followers on Twitter, and I was a bit addicted to social media. So
you were
it was
an
a
online
big,
person.
I was a very online person. And I tell you something, like, the thing I would like to say is, I'll go back to social media in a sec, but there's a woman on my street called Bettina who is an end-of-life person. And it's funny because I knew her slightly before, but when all of this happened, I had this real feeling that I wanted to go and have a chat with Bettina. And then I went, oh, why am I doing this? She's an end-of-life person. Why am I going to see someone? But actually, I went to her house and we had this amazing chat. And Bettina is from Germany. And she told me about a saying in Germany called illness, a chance, right?
Right.
And it really was very impactful when she said that, because I could see straight away what she meant. You go through these things, whether it's cancer or it's something else, something really devastating happens. And there's an opportunity in that. There's a gift in that as well, if you choose to kind of look at it that way. And for me, two of the big gifts have been giving up alcohol, because I have just, it's the best thing I've ever done. The second thing is giving up social media and allowing my head to have space. My head was full of rubbish before, I would say, being on social media. It was full of bits of information about people and things that I did not need to be having. And I have now a clear head. And if there's something really important on social media that I need to see, it comes through in the papers or somewhere else, or someone tells you and you go and you look at it. So it's not like you're shutting yourself off from important information. But most of it, let's be honest, is crap. So you don't have that stuff in your head anymore. So going back
to... Do you have a new clarity about things, do you think?
A little bit. I mean, certainly
about what's
for
important
myself,
and what isn't.
Yeah, I think that... I mean, that's the kind of... It sounds a bit of a cliche, but yeah, there's a profound thing in that. Like, I'm still very much a work in progress, as we all are, but I think that it helped me to kind of really find the person that I want to be, that I've, you know, that I'm always trying to be a bit better, trying to be a bit better. And this helped me in a huge way very quickly to kind of get on that path. And the alcohol was a big one because I abused alcohol, I would say. I drank too much, definitely. And I drank in a way that wasn't healthy. Okay. And that's gone out of my life. And that's amazing. Social media, I was on it too much. I was looking at things like that and that's gone. And there's other things too. And I do feel a bit more clarity. And I feel, I also just have that message of, you know, when something like this happens, all the people who love you and friends, family, colleagues, the amount of support. Now, I'm also aware that lots of people don't have support. So I've been thinking a lot about how people going through something like this on their own, like there are people who are very lonely in it. And then they can get support from ARC. ARC is another place I'd like to mention because they gave counselling to the girls, to Johnny. I got counselling to Mother as well, from the psycho-oncology department in the matter. And there's so many amazing supports there for people who maybe don't have the privilege of what I have, a great circle around me. Because it can be a very lonely place, you know, to be when you're in this situation.
I bet. And I'm surprised that you... felt you needed counselling because you always seem like such a strong person. I feel like you'd be the one counselling the counsellor in a way. But clearly, this has been a very, very hard time for you.
Yes, but I didn't go meekly to the
counsellor. You didn't want to go.
I didn't want to go. I think they recognised, my family around me recognised that I wasn't quite going at my full speed and behaving quite normally. So they insisted, and luckily enough, I got a lovely woman in there who talked to me. I don't think we talked a lot about Roisin. I think we talked about me.
And what did you get out of it?
I got out of the feeling that I was doing okay, that I was on the right path. You know, that, as I mentioned, that codependency before, that's an awful trap to get into when you feel that you have to mind her all the time. She had her husband, she had her children, she had the rest of the family who were...
But she's still your little girl as well.
Like, exactly.
And like any of us, with seeing your child go through that, and the old cliche of I wish it was me, you know, I take it off her.
Brendan. And of course, when she first got it, I thought, when the breast cancer was called, I said, oh, you'll be grand. I had that a couple of years ago. They took it away, it'll all be grand. And then when the bad stuff started coming, I had to sit back and take that all in. But the counselling helped me to know, yes, you can do this and you're doing the right thing. Stay on that path. And so I don't know whether how much Roisin influenced me or I influenced Roisin, but we just were in sync, and that's very important.
Brendan, I'd also like to... You talked earlier about the language and, you know, fighting and battling and stuff. Now, I know there's some people with cancer who like to frame it that way, or with other illnesses indeed. So I'm not taking away from that. And nothing we say here is to try and say anybody should behave a certain way, because it's very individual.
This is your truth, and everybody will have their own story.
Story is individual. But for me, in terms of the language, like I don't feel like I'm fighting or battling something, because this thing happened to me. Living in a body, things happen. That's the way it is, right? And this is the thing that's happened to me. I don't feel like cancer is a sentient thing that is doing something to me. Ha ha, look, I'm going to get Roisin Ingle. Her life is too nice. I'll do this. It doesn't feel like that to me. It feels like, okay, and that acceptance, right, it's been really important.
Okay.
And also the realization that I have an ability to look at it a certain way, and that can reduce the suffering that I have to feel. The way I'm framing it makes it less hard, because I've decided to look at it a certain way. And I know that everyone can't do that, right? But if you can try to do that, if you can realise that this guy, Thich Nhat Hanh, you know him a lot, he's a Buddhist guy, but he talks about us being millions of television channels. And it depends which channel you want to tune into. You can tune into the channel that says everything is terrible and I'm going to have a terrible time, or you can tune into the one that says life is still full of beautiful things and life is still good. But I would like to say, because I think it's really helpful, if you're someone who loves someone who's going through this, try and tune into how they're coping and what is their coping strategy, and do that by asking questions. Don't just assume, oh, they'll want to hear about this other cancer story, or they'll want to get this link to this news piece about something. Check in. How are you dealing with it? What are you able for? And then if you're the person who's doing it, like me, I found if I told people, I'm not Googling anything, so please don't send me. I'm not doing this, I'm doing that. Then at least you're giving them information that's helpful for them to know how to deal with you. But I think that communication is really important, because we oftentimes assume.
I can see it that it has been so important for both of you.
Yes. But that battle.
How are you now, Roisin?
I'm doing really well. So I'm on the immunotherapy drugs. I will be on them for the rest of my life, which I hope is going to be many long years, as Emily Harold says. I go into the matter every 3 weeks. I get this injection, which is it's a thing called Phesgo. That's just an extra detail, and it's keeping the cancer stable. And that's what I hope will be the case for a long time. And it's not getting rid of it necessarily. It's just making sure that it sort of stays as it is. And I get a bone strengthener. I get something called Zoladex, which shuts down the ovaries because it was estrogen driven. So that helps with that. And I take a tablet. But it's all stuff I can manage and live with. And I'm, you know, that's my life. And my life has changed slightly. Like I wasn't really one for going to the doctor or doing anything medical. So I now know the matter like the back of my hand. So if anyone needs any, because sometimes people get lost. And I love everyone in there. And I used to not like hospitals. And I really don't mind going in. So that's my life. And I'm back at work in the Irish Times a good while. And
on that note, by the way, so you mentioned you wrote a stunning piece for the Irish Times on Christmas Eve. And I'd encourage people to go and find it there online, because really it's quite unlike any other piece like this that I've ever read. But readers will also be delighted to hear that you're back writing your column again soon.
That sort of happened accidentally, and I will be having a column on Wednesday. And I'm so happy because I stopped writing the column as well as the social media. You know, my column is very personal. It's about my life. I didn't feel able to carry on and pretend. I didn't really want to be public about this. Yeah. And then I got to a point where I could be. So I can now write my column, and maybe it will have a little thread of this in it, and sometimes it won't. Maybe I'll talk about how brilliant I am at Scrabble now that I don't drink, because I have really improved my Scrabble. During the chemotherapy, I went to my friend Jerry's house every Tuesdays with Jerry, and we played Scrabble. And that was a huge part of helping me through, just to have a normal day playing a game I love. And I'm all about the 7-letter words now. I'm really great at Scrabble, if anyone wants to take me on.
Okay, so look, we'll see you both again soon, and we'll talk about other people's problems again, okay? But Roisin and Anne Ingle, I'm in awe of both of you.
Brendan, thank you very much.
No, thank you both so much. We'll take a break.
Thank you, Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.